From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 321, recorded live Wednesday, June 6th, 2012. This episode is brought to you by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support, online at telerik.com, and by franklins.net, training developers to work smarter, and now offering Gesture Pack, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Jeff Atwood.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Checking in with Jeff Atwood. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Scott.
So you're home.
Yeah, I've been on paternity leave effectively for the last 4 months. The babies are just now getting to be 4 months old, and this is two babies at once. This is two human beings in parallel. And everyone knows how hard it is to program threads, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that's also true of babies.
Well, and you've got rock hard awesome, your three-year-old?
Yeah, and he's doing great. Gosh, Henry is, he's such a great big brother.
And now you've got two more. So you're doing effectively a zone defense rather than a man-to-man defense.
The timing is good, though, because Henry is a little over three, and he's getting to where he can go to the bathroom by himself, and we don't have to watch him all the time to make sure he's not going to kill himself.
Yeah.
So he's just sort of getting to be where he can be almost helpful a lot of the times,
mm-hmm.
And that's great. Like, I don't know how you would do this if you had, say you had a kid, a newborn, a one-year-old, and a two-year-old. To me, that would be like, wow, I don't know how you would do that, because, yeah. At some point, it's interesting with kids, like you start realizing they're working on your team. They're part of your posse. You know, they're one of your homies, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're there to help you. It's hard to see it that way initially because it's a lot of work. But it does start to seem like that, and that's really cool. Like, he and I are playing through all the Lego games now.
Yeah.
Well, let me restate. He watches and I play.
This is the Lego Star Wars and Lego the
video
games.
Yeah, Lego Star Wars. And he loves Lego Indiana Jones so much. And we got Lego Pirates. We have all the Lego titles, Lego Batman. We're very excited because Lego Batman 2 is about to come out in like a week or so. It looks really cool because it has Superman and Green Lantern and stuff. And so that's fun. And it's fun to sort of involve him. And he doesn't play necessarily, but he helps me. He points mm-hmm. out things I can do and that sort of stuff. So it's starting to be a lot more fun.
How much screen time? How have you decided that?
How much time he gets in front of the television?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
It's like a big parenting thing. Big parenting decision is like, how much do you put your kid in front of a screen?
The official American pediatrics, blah, 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 is you're not supposed to do too much before the age of two.
Mm-hmm.
But after the age of two, it's kind of up to the parent's discretion for the doctor. So personally, I mean, I don't want to say we do a lot, but like, it's one of the few ways. He's a very high energy child. It's very difficult to get him to focus on anything.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's nice to be able to turn on, you know, some cool cartoon. Like, we have the Batman cartoons, the animated Batman, which is quite good.
Right.
And, you know, we'll turn that on and he'll watch for a while. But he doesn't really get addicted. Like, he likes to see a lot of different things. He doesn't ask for the same things too much over and over. So I'm pretty flexible because, you know, I love these cartoons. And part of this is my heritage, too. It's like, you know, I get to have these experiences with him alongside him. So I try to pick out stuff I haven't seen and I would like to see and that mm-hmm. he can watch too.
Yeah.
We've rewatched Pee-wee's Big Adventure like 10 times. And I swear that's like the best movie. I know it doesn't seem that way. It seems like this cultural ephemera, but Pee-wee's Big Adventure was like Tim Burton's first movie.
Yeah.
It's good on a lot of different levels, right? It has these subtle jokes and.
Is this okay for kids? Is there anything in there I should worry about?
There's the one scene with Large Marge. Remember the scene with the trucker lady?
Right.
She picks him up and she becomes very scary at one point in that. That's the only part that I get nervous about showing to Henry, but the rest of it is really very mild, very mild.
That makes me feel better about, because we just watched Star Wars.
Oh, yeah?
We just went through the first three Star Wars, four, five, and six, rather. And I wrote a whole blog post about when to introduce your children to Star Wars. And it was
great.
It was a really interesting post because I thought I was being fairly logical about it, and the responses were basically totally awesome, I love this, or, you know, what is wrong with you showing your child Star Wars? And we had a good time with it, though. We're doing it in machete ordering. Have you heard of this?
Machete ordering? No, I haven't.
Yeah, machete ordering is 4, 5, 6, 2, 3, so you skip episode 1 entirely. And there's this there's this whole intense, deep analysis of like exactly why episode one provides zero value and how, you know, if they never know who Darth Maul is and all this kind of stuff, then this is what they'll think about the previous ones. And it's basically, it's the ordering that that keeps all of the fun, like, oh my goodness, it's really his father. And oh my God, they're twins. And, you know, all the surprises are maintained without Jar Jar.
I'm pretty sure the whole world is a little bit better without Jar Jar. So.
Absolutely, absolutely. And then you introduce episode one, like, a year later as, like, a bit of, this is the Apocrypha, like, this is the appendix. It's kind of this useless little movie, but it was kind of interesting. And then we also, I tried to decide, do I want to show them the special editions or the original editions or something in between? And I found that there's this guy named Harmy, H-A-R-M-Y, who did a thing called the Harmy Despecialized Edition, where he took everything that was good about the specialized editions and then all the crappy bits and literally re-edited the entire movie and like re-rotoscoped the lightsabers and redid a bunch of stuff. And he basically made a 720p high-def version of Star Wars that is as close to the one you saw as a kid in the theaters as there is possible.
So he de-Lucas'd it.
Well, he de-Lucas'd it, but he also kept some good parts. Like there's a do-back or two occasionally when they're wandering on a Tatooine because that was okay. But all of the like super excessive and obvious stuff, like, you know, Han walking over Jabba's tail was just, they just yanked it because it's like, that's just offensive.
Right.
So this was for the 4-year-old and the 6-year-old. And the only bit that I didn't show them was when Obi-Wan cuts this dude's arm off in the bar. And I was like, you know, I think the traumatic amputation is probably not cool. But, you know, blaster fights when guys just fall over was totally fine.
Well, I did some research on this. We have at Stack Exchange, they have a parenting site. And one of the questions I asked was about the influence of cartoon violence on children, because I was looking at some of the cartoons I had watched as a kid and seeing how violent they were. And like Tom and Jerry, for example, is extremely violent. Almost, I think that's what Itchy and Scratchy was based on. And the research shows that as long as it's visibly like a cartoon, like what seems to be risky is like real actors, like human beings, pantomiming violence, that is much riskier than cartoons doing it. So that's why when it comes to cartoon content, that's why almost everything I show Henry is pretty much cartoons of some form. and I'm a little bit more comfortable with that, even as long as I'm there to sort of supervise and explain what's going on and that sort of thing.
Mm. So you wouldn't show him actual Indiana Jones?
No, I thought about that.
Like face
melting. I
realized
there's a lot of scenes that are kind of scary with like human looking human beings.
And
there seems to be this sort of like protection of it being a cartoon. Yeah. So.
Well, when that Nazi's face melted,
I remember
as a kid, that was the scariest thing that I had ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah.
As a child.
Well, you know, it's fun to play that stuff in Lego, all the Lego versions of the movies. Now there's going to be Lego Lord of the Rings. Did you hear about this?
Oh, you're kidding.
I like those a lot because they sort of cut out a lot of the scarier stuff and make it this sort of fun, like, oh, it's just Lego blocks. But, you know, they're blowing, there's guns, they're shooting.
Yeah.
So it's sort of real world-ish, but it's enough of a mirror.
Have you had the guns conversation with your wife?
What's that?
Like guns. Like where does that fit in?
Oh, well, let me just summarize that women don't like guns, whereas most dudes kind of like the guns.
Oh, yeah. And
I had posted on Twitter, I don't know if you saw this, but I had posted on Twitter that the other day Henry was using a flower to pew-pew something. He literally picked up a flower off the ground and was going, pew-pew-pew. It was like, make war, not love, right? picked up a flower and was shooting people with it. And I was like, wow, how do you really combat that? It seems like there's some part of little boys that's just really into the pew-pew, right? And I call it the pew-pew.
Yeah, yeah.
At least that way we don't say gun. But, you know, women just really don't like it and aren't into it. And I'm not saying I do play a lot of games that involve guns. So I don't want to say I like guns because that sounds weird. But there's a part of it I understand, like the pew-pew stuff. I get it. Mm-hmm. And you see a lot of it. And I don't know sort of how to manage that. All the responses on Twitter said, you can't control this because we have sons. We tried to do it and that they would like make guns out of like toast at breakfast. Like whatever objects they had, I heard the story 15 different times in 15 different ways. Whatever objects they have access to will become pew-pew, right?
Right, but there's got to be some PhD's thesis about this. Like your wife's a PhD. She should be able to go and like figure this out. Like what is it? I mean, like we tried to keep guns away from them until at least 4 or 5 and they figured it out. Like as soon as they could point a stick at someone and like declare destruction upon them, it was figured out on their own. Like I think they literally would have invented guns if they were all alone in a room. without any adults.
Yeah. And the other thing that's funny, too, is I was reading a book by that guy, A.J. Jacobs, who I've talked to you about before, who I think is great. He did The Year of Living Biblically. And
right. Great author.
All those. Yeah, really, really funny guy. And he said his son started telling stories, and the end of every story was, and then everybody died. That was just like the normal way for them to end stories. It's like, oh, yeah, everybody dies, right?
Yeah, so, our kids put everyone in jail or they all die. You know, like if you don't like somebody, you put them in jail. Like they'll nice. Fight it with each other and one will just declare, yeah, he should totally go to jail for that. I'm like, really? Forever? Yeah.
This is one of the reasons I was kind of glad that the twin babies we just had were girls was one, because I want to have the girl experience, and two, because the energy level can be hard to deal with the dudes sometimes. I mean, it's great. You know, I love him, but man, two more of Henry would have been, very intimidating.
Yeah.
From a parenting perspective. And I think girls do tend to be just a wee bit calmer, maybe not so much into the pew pew. Granted, it gets a lot weirder when they turn 13 and the whole sex thing comes up. But
see, that's
right
the
now,
thing that they say, that the babies, like boys are like chaos from like 0 to 10, and then girls are chaos from 10 to 20.
But that's so far in the future right now, I'm just willing to amortize that cost. I'm like, I don't care. I'll take 10 years of slightly easier. That's a reasonable trade-off for me.
That's crazy. So what else are you doing? I notice you're blogging more.
Yeah, I've been writing a lot more.
I keep seeing you on Hacker News to the point where the guys on Hacker News are tired of seeing you.
Well, I don't try to get on Hacker News. And I actually try to avoid going to Hacker News. I actually try to avoid reading a lot of feedback on my stuff now. I mean, I want to be responsive to comments because I really do believe in that dialogue of people posting, you know, interesting commentary on the post, like adding stuff, like asking, why did you post about this, or clarifications. I've gotten really good information from comments, and I continue to believe in the value of comments. But there's also this, I think off-site commentary, there's this whole dynamic of on-site commentary where they're sort of in your house and maybe they're a little bit more respectful. And then there's off-site commentary where they have their own communities and they may not even like you as a writer, which is okay. Like, you don't have to like me. You don't have to respect me. But the tone can get weird, right? So like sometimes I just don't want to even go there until like days later, just sort of read it after the fact versus getting embroiled in a bunch of, you know, commenting back and forth about what's going on, because what they're doing there really isn't about me. It's like me being there isn't that helpful, right? Mm-hmm. I said my piece on the blog. It's not my house. It's not my blog. So, I mean, I'm free to read it like anyone else, but it's, I don't know. More and more, I believe these offsite commenting communities are, you should be very, very hands off with them. You shouldn't be over there interacting with them too much.
It seems like some people are willing to turn comments off on their blog. And then, like, I was talking to Reginald Braithwaite, Reaganwald. Mm-hmm. And I'll be doing a show with him on This Developer's Life in a week or two. And he basically said, you know, that is his community. So he puts stuff on his blog, which has no comments. And then if comments fire up somewhere, then he'll link over to there. And that's where the conversation happens. But from my perspective, people who do off-site comments get really negative comments. Like people are willing, like you cultivate your community on your blog. But as far as kindness, you know, like good luck getting kindness on an offsite comment location. I've had some mean comments on like Stack Overflow and Hacker News.
Well, Stack Overflow is not a commenting community.
Not Stack Overflow, rather, excuse me. /. Pardon.
Okay, I was going to say.
No, that's not, yeah, anyway. The point is, though, Hacker News is offsite comments, and that's where like people are willing to like let their hair down.
Right. Well, it's an interesting dynamic, and I love communities like that, but I do think it's a very different thing from having comments on your own site. I don't think it replaces that at all. In fact, I think you lose something. I think you lose some of the, a little bit of civility and some of the, I don't know, it's just a different tone. Now, one thing I wrote recently that got a lot of traction that, again, I don't sit down and write with the intention of like, I'm going to make this big deal out of this and it's going to blow up, right? It was the don't learn to code thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a nice response to that. I really liked your response because that's kind of the same thing I was trying to say, which was, you know, your analogy was the plumbing. It's like, well, I don't need to learn plumbing, but then I had a plumbing problem. Like the ring fell down in the sink. I was like, well, how do I figure this out? And, you know, I've done that too. Like we had the sink got clogged here, like after Thanksgiving, which always happens with the potatoes, apparently. And I went in and I bought a little bit of plumbing equipment and I basically roto-rootered in a very ghetto way, like the actual under the sink, like where it actually goes under the house to clear it out. And I was like proud of myself. I was like, yay, I'm a plumber. I'm pretty sure I posted on Twitter about this. Because I was so proud of myself. But I support that just-in-time sort of way of figuring this stuff out. But where I really worry, and where I wanted there to be a little bit of counter-programming, was that people that are saying with a straight face that programming is as important to a child to learn as reading, writing, and math.
Yeah.
That really bothers me. Because, A, not enough people are actually good at reading, writing, and math, first of all, before we start adding stuff to the list, right?
Yeah.
And second, like, I don't believe that. Like, I want people to use computers. I want them to love computers. But I don't want everybody to have to feel like they have to be a programmer. I feel like that's like a failure case for the industry. It's like, oh, well, you got to program, you know? It's like the whole point of this is like the computer is an awesome tool that gets out of the way and lets you do your thing, man. And if your thing happens to be like programming, hey, that's awesome. Go for it. But for a lot of people, hey, I'm a writer, you know? I just want to write.
Yeah, I was really surprised that
all in your face.
I was totally surprised that that blew up into a thing at all. Like, and then you and Zed had a lovely back and forth on Twitter. That was really something.
Well, he likes to yell at people. It's just what he does.
But I didn't think it was that. I mean, I thought that your title was a little link bait, but everyone's title is link bait these days. I think that the point was learn to think, but to say learn to program, I mean, frankly, in the future, I would hope that programming as a verb would not be a word anymore. You know, computers should be usable. If we have to teach everyone to program, then we're not really doing a very good job.
Well, that's right. And, you know, also, what will programming be? You know, I mean, is it JavaScript? Is it Ruby? Is it C#? Is it
Excel?
COBOL? Is it C? I'm not even sure we really understand what it's going to be in 20, 30 years. So when we're recommending, it's like, oh, go learn X. It's like, I'm not convinced X is really the right thing. You know, like this stuff is changing a lot. Now, granted, if you're a C programmer, you'll be saying, why, by golly, nothing has changed at all since 1970 when I learned how to program C. You know, and that's true in some cases, but I don't think we're really good at identifying what those areas are. You know,
it's funny how the age thing though makes a difference. I mean, the older I get, the more I've got that like old, that kind of get off my lawn attitude, that kind of neck beard kind of thing where it's like, you know, we're doing some pretty cool stuff with Azure right now, but then I'm realizing that we've built the 5 mainframes that the guy in IBM in 1950 said that the world would only need 5 computers. And now we've gone and we've built those 5 computers, you know?
Yeah. Well, computers are everywhere, right? I mean, like, phones are incredibly powerful computers. Like when I was writing, I wrote about the whole iPad thing where, you know, the post-PC era, like to me, what marked the post-PC era was the iPad was giving me something I had wanted on my desktop for, I swear to God, 15 years. It was like, give me a truly high resolution display. None of this 1024 by 768 bull crap. I want super high res, right? Like a book.
Right.
I've been waiting for this forever. You cannot buy this for any amount of money. There was one IBM display for like $4,000 that nobody had. But it just didn't exist. And now Apple says, hey, cool, super high-res display. So I was like, oh, my God, thank you, finally, right? Like, and it came on a tablet. It was like the innovation is happening now outside the PC.
Right.
Which should be a little scary if you're in the PC world. But, you know, to me, that's really important
stuff. It is bizarre that my iPad has a higher resolution than my 30-inch Dell.
Well, exactly.
Like, how is that okay, you know?
Well, granted, there's a physics problem. I mean, if your 30-inch monitor had the same DPI, it would be kind of hard for your video card to probably drive it.
Well, why? My iPad seems to be able to pull it off.
It probably could, but you'd need a pretty decent video card. And anything 3D would start to get scary. So I realize there's a reason it's happening on phones, like really small things first and scaling up. But I feel like the PC industry wasn't even trying on this stuff. And, you know, the rumor is that, you know, next week Apple's going to introduce, you know, Retina display Macs and stuff. And I'm like, well, again, why why have we had to wait so long for this stuff to happen? Now, I realize high DPI is complicated on the desktop because, you know, how do you scale stuff that's bitmaps? There's a lot of bitmappy UI elements and all that stuff. It's not like we have, you know, PostScript on the desktop like the next step boxes or whatever.
Right.
So I realize it's a hard problem, but it's taken us just absurd amounts of time to make progress. And that's why the progress is happening sort of outside that ecosystem, because it's easier when you're starting on your own device. You control the ecosystem. You know, there's not, I mean, how much history does the iPad have? It was introduced in, what, 2010? It's a 2-year-old device. So it's easier for them to go back and rewrite history and say, well, hey, everything is twice the resolution it used to be, right?
Right. Well, and the way that the iOS folks have done it, and the way Apple's always done it, I've said this before on the show, is that kind of like the dirty little secret about like why Apple is so pretty and why they're able to make things so perfectly anti-aliased is that the entire operating system is like held together with like PostScript and transparent PNGs. And as long as you keep increasing the resolution by a nice clean factor of 2, you know, or factor of 4, depending on how you look at it, then yeah, you just make whatever .png x2 and things continue to be clean. And if you've got an ecosystem of Photoshop experts, then, you know, high DPI PNGs and a lot of transparency, and you're going to have a gorgeous operating system. But with Windows, you've got this kind of weird half vectors, half bitmaps, multi-resolution icons thing. I mean, who's got the time to make 15 different ICO files?
The other thing I've noticed, particularly on the iPad, is people complain, like, everything should be high res now. And that's actually not true. If I'm browsing the web for the most part, I don't really notice that everything is scaled up. But what does scale really, really badly, and this is kind of what you're talking about, is small stuff. Like a 16 by 16 toolbar icon scaled up will look horrible.
Right.
Because you have so little data to work with, right?
Right.
Whereas if it's like a 320 by 200 thing, it's not really going to look that bad if you scale it up by X2. But small stuff, like you would find on UIs and stuff, looks unusually bad scaled up. So I appreciate that that's a particular area they have to work
on. But there's
on.
A science of icon creation, and I've talked to icon designers, and once you get below 64 by 64, they recommend that you redraw them from scratch. So, you know, see what I'm saying? Like, you can't take a gorgeous 256 by 256 icon and then make it 8x8 and expect to get anything other than a smudge.
Well, I think SVG support, at least as far as on the web goes, for small stuff, you could argue that small stuff, you could probably draw some of the small stuff as SVGs, although I also hear what you're saying about, like, just tweaking the pixels when you only have 16 by 16 to work with.
Yeah.
It's like you almost hinting isn't even enough. You just have to do
exactly.
it by hand.
Well, anti-aliasing will go and work against you, and then it's time to start thinking about how to make this as clear as possible. And if you've got a multi-element icon, you're just going to start dropping elements out. You know what I mean?
Well, I think they also had like somebody introduced like a font recently that was like a bunch of like essentially wingdings for the web, so that you could use that instead of relying on small images and stuff. But, you know, I love this high-res stuff. And, you know, I'm actually going to go on record here saying that I'm really strongly considering actually switching to Mac, like, if they do the Retina display thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I don't know, just to me, I spend so much time reading text on the screen, and I just need it to look good. Like, I mean, to me, like, readability is like, you know, motherhood and apple pie. I mean, this is resolution is what it's all about. And if it takes me getting a Mac to do that, then I'm very, very tempted to do that.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see who gets there first, because I'm reading on the Windows 8 blog that they've got the high DPI stuff baked in. There's just no hardware to do it. But they seem to have thought about that. I just want to see, like, do they switch to from TrueType anti-aliasing to grayscale to none? I mean, do you need anti-aliasing at 300 DPI?
You do. It's a point of diminishing returns, of course. But I do think it does look better.
Yeah.
Like, if you just take a screenshot on your iPad, and you'll see it's indeed anti-aliasing.
But my laser printer doesn't need to anti-aliase.
You don't need that tricky RGB anti-aliasing. Because RGB anti-aliasing, the other problem with that is the rotation factor, particularly on a tablet.
Yeah.
It's assuming a certain orientation of the RGB layout, and that changes when you turn the display. So you go from, say, 3x simulated horizontal width to 3x simulated vertical width, which isn't really, or vertical height, which isn't that helpful.
Yeah.
So there's that problem as well, the whole orientation rotation. And it was funny to see that IE and like with the 9 and 10, and also Firefox, but Chrome has not done this yet. They actually switched to a different rendering model for the fonts.
Yeah, I noticed that. I saw a thing on Long Zhang's blog, I started something .com, where chunks of Windows 8 aren't using ClearType. They're using grayscale.
Yeah, because of rotation and... Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of reasons that you would want to do that. Another would be high resolution.
Have you, when I talked to you earlier, you said you were playing with Windows 8?
Yeah, I'd been reading a little bit about it, and I liked what I saw, actually, a lot. But this is the first time I actually installed it, because we had a laptop that had a bum SSD that just died. It never really, it was always kind of sketchy. It was just a bad SSD purchase, I guess. But it finally died, so I put a new drive in. I was like, okay, I'll just install Windows 8 from scratch and test it out and see what I think. Because I had heard some complaints, right? I heard people complaining that, you know, basically it's too different. They're not sure if people like it. It's too tablet-y. But I really, really like it. Like, I think it's clearly better. Like, I would almost go so far as to say this is, I think, the best UI iteration they've done since Windows 95. You know, maybe the only UI iteration that they've done since Windows 95, right?
Right.
And when was the last time they changed this much stuff?
No, I mean, honestly, Windows 7 and Windows 95, other than the taskbar, which I think is Windows 7's kind of like gift to the world, because you can see, you know, the way that the dock in iOS is and the taskbar in Windows 7 are kind of converging onto one thing, and now Unity and the way the dock works and Ubuntu. I mean, effectively, everyone has a dock now. And then you've got Metro on Windows 8, and you've got kind of Launchpad on iOS. It's all just a different way to look at your icons, you know, ultimately.
Well, right. And I had been beefing for a while on Twitter about the iPhone, the iOS UI, which is basically, it's a desktop area with a field of icons. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, that's Windows 3.1, literally. It's a field with a bunch of icons on it. And they're not even that dynamic. That was my other beef, was like, if you look at the iOS apps, like the calendar app shows the current date, which some people don't even notice that actually. But the pictures icon does not show you your current picture, right? It just shows that generic, whatever, sunflower. So I've learned to look for that sunflower. But I would rather see one of my pictures in there. Like, one of the things that I thought was obvious was that you want these tiles to be dynamic, right? If they're icons, just have them do stuff, right? Like, I don't need to see the mail icon 50,000 times, right? Show me something else in that space that's useful. And I think the Windows 8 and of course, the Windows Phone does that beautifully. Like, when I hit the Windows key, you know, I get the – basically, the Windows key is what I've used, the new Start menu. The new Start menu is now full screen, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And it's in Metro visual style.
Right.
But it's showing me all this information. I see the current date. I see the weather. I see, you know, all this stuff like is live and updating. I'm like, that's cool, right? That's a really good use of screen space.
Isn't it jarring though? I mean, that's the one thing I can't get my brain around, is that I'm sitting here with three monitors. And while I get the idea of a tablet that is a Windows tablet, lets me run all my Win 7 stuff, and then has this Metro thing for the days when I just want to like check the news in full screen. But, and I know you're big on, you don't like window management, and if you can avoid it, and the kind of the moving around and shoving around of windows is not, that's really the most, it's the biggest busy work that we do in our lives, is just moving a window from one side to the other. So, you know, things like iOS and Windows 8 will prevent a lot of that kind of a work. But when you're sitting on the desktop and you hit the Start menu just to go and run something, it's like switching into an alternate dimension. It's so jarring. How is that going to work across three monitors? You know, do I need that kind of stress in my life?
Well, does it? I've only tried it on laptops. So I haven't actually tried it on a multi-monitor setup. Does it? I would assume it only replaces the primary monitor.
I believe they. I'm not sure, and I'm sure I'll be wrong, because that's how it works on podcasts. You say something, and then you get an email later that you're wrong. But I believe that whatever your mouse is where it will bring that menu up.
Okay. Well, I read, there's a really good article on this by Peter Bright, who's a columnist at Ars Technica, world's angriest columnist. Mm-hmm. But he is a good columnist, and he wrote a lot about this and the multi-monitor stuff. Because they're actually, this is the first version of Windows that actually has decent multi-monitor support. I mean, other than it just working, mm-hmm. it actually has like, oh, the taskbar extends to all the monitors, right? They actually thought about it more than getting it basically working. Mm-hmm. And it's still better than, you know, OS X, because in OS X, you have that menu strip at the top of the monitor. That menu strip does not scale well when you have like three monitors. Then you mm-hmm. have like a menu in the far, far left upper corner of the first of three monitors. Mm-hmm. So they're not the first company to sort of struggle with, you know, how do we get our UI to extend to multiple monitors? But I'm also realistic and pragmatic, and then I view not that many people are going to have multiple monitors. I mean, some people might set up like a second monitor. But the people like me who have three monitors are kind of freaks in a good way, I think. Mm-hmm. But I can totally understand that they aren't exactly optimizing for this case. And I can't really begrudge them that, because
yeah, we are the one. I mean, that is the thing. All of us are the 1% case. This is the thing that's killing me. People are getting all mad at me, and they're tweeting me, and they're like, oh, I can't believe Microsoft's doing that. You know, but then they've got these stats where like 0.1% of people use this feature. And that's always the feature that the person is enraged about, you know.
Right.
And that's great but the problem is when 100% of people who are me use that feature, that's very frustrating.
Yeah, it is. But as a new Start menu, I quite like the Metro UI. Mm-hmm. I mean, even if I don't get into the whole everything running in Metro, just as a new Start menu, it's pretty win, because I can start typing, you know, and it matches a bunch of stuff, and it's a really elegant way to just type, like I, you know, and find things. That hasn't gone away. Mm-hmm. There's also like core improvements, like ISO files are mm-hmm. now like, I don't have to run a special software to freaking mount ISO images anymore.
Yeah, it is a little
How many years have I been waiting for that?
What do you think about that new motion thing that everyone's talking about, the Kinect competitor? It's like a little mouse-looking thing you put in front of your PC.
I didn't read much about that, but I read that it can detect like really tiny, tiny finger motions.
1 millimeter or something?
Yeah.
Basically, it's like, you know, I've got a Kinect in front of my Windows machine here. That I won in a contest, and I'm waiting for that that thing, you know, like the software that makes that happen. Like all I want to do is like, I'm looking at a Skype window with you in it. I want to just put my hand up and then just make a flicking motion and move that to the left. Like that seems like a driver that should be built in.
You know, I'd really have to play with that. I mean, Kinect is obviously like a 10-foot UI, big time.
Right.
So like, I don't even know how that would extend.
Well, but not the new one. Not the new one. So the new Kinect supports, they call it near mode. So you get skeletal tracking of seated people a foot away. So the Windows Kinect is different than the Xbox Kinect.
Well, but then there's that competitor you're talking about that actually is designed.
Leap motion. Field.
Yes, that. Right. Yeah. I don't know. I'd have to play with it. I don't know.
Yeah.
After using the iPad, I've definitely warmed up to touch as like a casual consumption interface. It certainly works great for that. It's absolutely horrible for typing any kind of content.
Yeah. I think that rather than saying that the era of the mouse and keyboard are over, I think it's the era of something else. Like you can't say that it's all about touch because we don't know. Like we all have these webcams pointing at us. I don't know why I need a second webcam. Like I've got this perfectly good webcam and I've got 8 processors to spare. Just detect that I'm moving my hand and move that window off to the side. Right? We have all the technology is in place. The fast processors and the webcams. Just use them.
Well, I don't think the webcam is quite enough, because if you look at Kinect, it has like depth sensors, it has infrared sensors. I mean, the reason Kinect was so cool was it had like, I think, 3 different kinds of sensors that were sort of shooting you. I mean, camera as well as some other stuff.
Yeah.
So I think we'd need that as well for that to truly take off.
Yeah, I think I'm a little jaded. I just feel like the hardware, there's so much hardware in front of us and there's just so little software to do the work.
But I don't know why people are beefing so hard about Windows 8. Like almost everything I see, I like. Like there's the new task manager is awesome. Mm-hmm. It's got the Office 2007 style UI on the Explorer, which I love. Mm-hmm. I've always loved that UI. I think it's way better than traditional menus. It boots faster, it loads faster. It sleeps faster. It's like, what's not to like, really? This is like maybe the best version of Windows I've ever seen.
The boot faster part is,
people are freaking out about
the boot faster part is crazy. Like the thing comes back from boot faster than it comes back from hibernation. Like I don't know. Like there's been a couple of times when it's actually come back from boot so fast, I've been suspicious that it was sleeping.
Well, I would recommend anybody listening really try out the preview. I mean, I really like it. I would argue maybe it's the best version of Windows there has ever been. And one of my complaints has been with Windows 7, certainly with Vista, this was a huge complaint, and with Windows 7 too, they didn't really change enough. You know, they didn't really innovate. They didn't do enough stuff. Hmm. Whereas in Windows 8, they clearly did a lot of stuff. They rethought a lot of the way things are working.
Yeah.
And I dig it, man.
Yeah,
I mean, I wish
good.
More.
I'm not there yet, man. I'm not there.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see.
I did train my wife in it. I actually observed her. There are a few things you have to learn, like the corners. The main thing that I would mention is you got to know that the corners are hot. And that's sort of how you activate things. It's kind of like, I think once you figure it out, you know it. But I can see where people are complaining that like maybe you need like a giant arrow saying, hey, drag your mouse to the corners, right?
Well, you remember when Windows 95 started out, what was the first thing that happened when you started up is that an arrow animated across the bottom of the taskbar to point at the giant button that said start.
You know, trivia, I actually was following Windows 95 really closely when it came out. I read like this book about Windows 95. I read it cover to cover like 3 times because I was like a little obsessed actually with it. I probably shouldn't admit this. But I was really obsessed with Windows 95. I was like, oh God, this is going to be great. And I had emailed somebody at Microsoft and I got a response from the guy who wrote that feature. Like there was something on Newsgroup or something, and this is back when people from Microsoft still read Newsgroups, I guess, and he was actually talking about it because that start thing, like I had never seen it, and he clarified something. He actually emailed me back about that feature. So
I remember. I think you're a fanboy, though. It sounds like you're officially a Windows 8 fanboy, or almost there.
I think so. I like it a lot more than I thought I would. Now, that said, I still mentioned earlier, just so that you don't think I'm a total fanboy, I'm probably going to switch to Mac.
Yeah, I did catch that part of the conversation earlier.
Yes. So I'm a little bit of both. You know, I like whatever works, man. Whatever. I just want there to be innovation, basically, right? And I think the Retina display is hugely innovative, hugely. Waiting for that for years. I think Windows 8 is actually very innovative in the way that they're changing, the way the start menu works, the way that the corners are hot, which is, you know, Fitts' law, all that stuff. And you know, the new design language of Metro, I think, is very cool. So,
well, I think we're definitely, you and I agree on that. It is about innovation. I just want things to keep being interesting, keep being useful. And my number one focus is that things need to care about the user. Anything that is user hostile, I get really angry about. But
well, even one of the things I like about Apple, actually, is that I feel like they're willing to sort of put the customer over the developers, even. You know, even if the developers, you know, are kind of the goose that lays the golden egg in some ways, Apple is not shy about giving their developer community kind of basically the finger, right? Like, in the name of the customer. It's like they have to protect the experience. And if they have to protect the experience by telling their developers to go away, like this whole, the way the App Store on the Mac is totally locked down now, right? And developers are really pissed off about that. But they're not shy about saying, you know what? This is about the user first, right? We're not about the developer. We're about the user, right?
Exactly. Exactly. We're all about the user. Thanks for hanging out with me today, Jeff.
Yeah, you're welcome.
All right. This has been another episode of Handsome Minutes. We'll see you again next week.